or being given them, does he accept them as his right, and though not demanding them, yet pleased withal when he receives them? It is a singular misconception of the Father of the universe, adhered to throughout such wide areas of the earth, that God should require heavy inundations of praise, and such praise, too, that in the end it is naught but the most fulsome adulation. Such a misconception is nothing but pure paganism. In ancient days, when there was a multiplicity of gods, it was felt that those same gods must be appeased at all costs. It occurred to the simple minds of those times that nothing could be more acceptable to any well-established and self-respecting god than to have a sufficient number of sacrifices and an adequate measure of praise. Gods needed self-abasement from their votaries, and they got it. They needed ritual of a high degree of mystery and elaboration, and they got it. Those ideas have become firmly and deeply rooted in millions of the earth's inhabitants of whatever religious persuasion, so that now you have the utterly untruthful spectacle of the one universal Father being submitted to the same treatment from organized religion of the present day, and from the same motives and for the same reasons as those of your pagan ancestors. This belief has colored the whole religious life of the earth world, or rather that part of it, known as Christendom. So many theological errors and fantastic beliefs really have their source in this notion that the Father must be appeased. It vitally alters the whole character of the Father, transforming him from a loving Father into a dreadful judge and tyrant, a God of vengeance and wrath, and making it a high encomium of any man that he should be described as God-fearing. The fearing, you will be told, in this connection, means reverencing or worshipping and not to be afraid of. Then why not use plain language? There is no merit in fear. It is singular that when one comes to speak of religious matters, words begin to alter their meanings in such ways as would never be tolerated for an instant in other concerns of the earthly life. In religion you may say one thing, while the words you actually employ, being deemed entirely opposite by many people, have a meaning directly opposed to the spoken or written word. Search the termination of the Lord's Prayer, and you will find a glaring example. No. Serving the Father does not consist of any of the strange performances so widely regarded on earth as true service. Incarnate man can be served in a myriad ways. You do not need me to tell you that. But it is not to say that one can leave out the Father altogether. Very far from it. You will say that it greatly depends upon whom one serves. The fellow whom you are serving may himself be worthless, and the service may be nothing but a support of base deeds. Of course, that is obvious. The service I am discussing with you has one designation only, and that is the service that is begotten of loving kindness. That one term will at once eliminate all that is not of the highest and purest motives. The kindness that a man shows to his fellows does not immediately appease a capricious and wrathful God. God is not visibly pleased in such cases, as the pious would have you believe, pleased with you because you have been kind or, on the other hand, wrathful and ready to strike down the person with whom he is not pleased. Those good actions are reflected upon ourselves, they bring beautiful colors into our spiritual lives, our etheric selves become brighter, and our very raiment adds more and still more luster to its texture. As you yourselves on earth add one kind action to another, so does your spirit body become brighter, and meet to dwell in the realms of light. Religious exercises may induce folk to think that they are making some degree of spiritual progression. They may be right or they may be wrong, according to varying circumstances. But there is no doubt whatever about their spiritual results of a kindly action, that, beyond all question, will have done them spiritual good indeed. It is the small services quickly performed, and often unobtrusively and soon forgotten by him who does it, that provide one with such spiritual riches. How many times have I seen folk awakening here in these beautiful realms of light, undergoing the most enjoyable surprise of their lives to find themselves where they are, and not in some dark deep dungeon of hell. Too good to be true, they think, because they never professed to be anything, they will say, when they were on earth. Just so. But during their lives, of maybe a very humdrum order, They have not forgotten their neighbor. Neither has the law forgotten to act whereby they have registered upon themselves the good that they have done before they came here to dwell. Such, my dear friends, is the material of which service is made, and by which progression is gained. Next headline is Christian Unity. If a religious-minded voyager from another planet were to visit the Earth in search of the true religion, what bewilderment would be his, how he would be confounded. It would be remarkable if, at the end of his quest, he departed for his own world with his sanity unimpaired. Religiously speaking, as well as in many other respects, the Earth presents a sad sight to us of the spirit world who are able to see what transpires there. Could that illustrious soul, who spoke to one small corner of the Earth nearly 2,000 years ago, have ever foreseen or imagined in what manner his words would have been written down, distorted, and later become the material for hundreds upon hundreds of contending religious parties, sects, and denominations? The word sect is a familiar one to you. It is the habit on Earth to address by that title other religious bodies as a means of showing the speaker's own religious superiority, and at the same time expressing contempt and disapproval of another denomination. Christianity is subdivided into almost numberless individual churches, with a corresponding profusion of perplexing doctrinal contentions. When I was upon earth I belonged successively to two denominations, the two principal ones of my native land. Even that statement would be challenged by the parties concerned, for neither would acknowledge that the other was the chief. In the second of these two bodies I was ordained priest, and so remained until I passed into the spirit world. Before I seceded from the first to the second, I went through the usual soul searching, found that I was profoundly dissatisfied with things as they were, and was received into what I fondly believed was the one true church. That brought me a measure of happiness, or at least contentment of mind. It was not till I arrived here at my dissolution that I saw that I had perturbed myself unnecessarily in the first instance, for neither of the two churches to which I had given my services as a minister was in possession of the truth. That raises a particular point in this subject of the true religion. Many folk on earth contend that no one religion does or can possess all spiritual truth, but that each religion has some truth in it. It is, however, a statement that leads to very great difficulties. How many religious denominations are there scattered throughout the earth world, that is to say, Christian denominations? There are hundreds. How is one to recognize the truth in any whose claims you may choose to examine? Is there any canon by which you could apply a test, any criterion? Those are two questions for you to answer. You may prefer to weigh the claims and pretensions of one against those of another, and then what? Trust your reason to do the rest. That is what I did when I became dissatisfied with the church in which I was brought up and of which my own father was the highest dignitary. I applied reason and logic, at least that is what I supposed myself to be doing. In point of fact, what I did was to examine the claims of both parties side by side, and so came to the conclusion that the party of the second part spoke with an authority which was completely lacking in the party of the first part. Then what happened? Proof, such proof as folk demand when it is declared that the spirit world exists, and that we, its inhabitants, can visit the earth and speak with our friends there, proof of that kind was wholly absent. I accepted the new position on faith alone, and later assumed the attitude that is common in that religious body, namely, that of spiritual superiority, religious intolerance and cockishness. I had come home, as my coreligionists are wont to term it. One used to hear, and you still do so now, much talk about Christian unity. I thought of that in my very early days, and often wondered why the churches could not unite. When I seceded, I knew the answer, as I thought, mine was the one true church, and infallible. How could truth be joined to error? All the other religious bodies were in a state of schism or heresy, or both. Even the holy orders which I believed I had possessed were denounced, and still are, as absolutely null and utterly void. I was, in fact, a layman when I had considered myself a properly ordained minister, so that, high dignitary of the church though my father was, when I seceded and was reordained, I was compelled to regard him as a layman by force of superior knowledge now that I had the true faith. Though at first I was a simple priest, yet was I canonically head and shoulders above my father because I had then been ordained validly. How poor, puny, and petty that all seems now. Even when I had made my immediate advent into spirit lands, I felt all this web of theology, which had entangled my mind. Had I but known it, to be falling away from me in the light of the real, absolute truth, I had, upon my secession, relinquished the shadow to grasp the substance, so I thought, but now I found that I had only exchanged one form of shadow for another. When I met my father here, you can imagine how rapturous were our first greetings, for we were met at last in the land where the truth abides upon every hand. How amused we were, as we went over together the various conversations we had had on earth, and bethought ourselves of the amount of time and effort and patience we had devoted to discussing the relative claims of at least two churches. We are now spiritually one in the supreme truth beyond all doubt, disputation, or speculation. That all or most of the religions on earth have some grain of truth in them, however small, is a statement that itself has a grain of truth in it. If you examine a few of them, you will perceive it for yourself. This is sometimes hailed as a sign of divine wisdom and authenticity, if I may so describe it. The truth, it is averred, cannot be entrusted to one religious body alone, but it is split up so that all religions possess a fraction of it which, when combined, make a perfect whole, and it is this combination, or gathering together of the absolute truth, that takes place in heaven. There are no religious controversies in that salubrious place because the one is in the presence of all the religions of earth and the truth is one at last. As a theory that is all very well. As a fact it is all very wrong. Certainly you will find someone teaching or another, in any specific religious body, which is a spiritual truth, but what of the rest of the same church's teachings? For the sake of possessing that one small truth, you must also submit to take upon yourself a load of spiritual errors. How are you to select from the whole body of one church's teaching that which is perfect truth? The only course is not to try, by anything approaching orthodox methods, as an alternative, and to be sure of being in complete possession of all the truth, you would have to become a member of all the religious denominations of the earth, both great and small, hundreds and hundreds of them, so as to be certain of not missing one fragment of the truth. That would be manifestly impossible, earthly life being so short. Even then, the problem would not be solved, for you would still be uncertain, to put it mildly, what was true spiritual teaching and what was not. Would it not be possible, do you think, to write down in parallel columns upon a very large sheet of paper the multiform teachings of all the churches, observing closely whether teachings or beliefs were exactly similar, or close enough for working purposes, then noting what was common to all and most repeated in some, and so strike a balance or effect a compromise? That way, I fear, would your difficulties only increase? Such method is something of the kind that is in the churchmen's minds when the cry for Christian unity goes up. Would it not be possible, they plead, for some least common factor to be found upon which all Christian churches could agree, and upon this basis unite, just as in the early days the church was one and undivided? Was it? Was the church ever in that perfect state? History and historians seem to declare that the church was always troubled with heresy, and by its members becoming dissatisfied with things as they were, and going off and founding religions of their own. Schisms and heresies have always existed. But could not one church or religious body, still to persist in the matter, be distinguished from all others as being the first? The absolute first, devolving without question from its founder. At last we seem to have arrived at our destination through our progress backwards in history and time. Of course, there must be an absolute first, but which, it is most difficult to say, for there are several claimants, each strenuously and with loud voice denying the others. When I was on earth I thought I had found the first and original, the only church. Everything seemed to point that way. It was comparatively easy to dispose of the claims of the others by listening to the voice of authority. The church to which I had previously belonged always boasted that it did not lay down any rigid canons of belief, but allowed its people to exercise their own private judgment, and think and believe practically what they liked. In this way, all schools of religious thought could be included within the one framework of the establishment. This, in effect, was what had always been done in this particular church ever since its foundation: liberty of thought, private judgment, until the liberty became a little too free and unrestrained, when the fires were lighted and the heretics burned for their rashness and wickedness. They were martyrs for the faith. Their crown of martyrdom has since become slightly tarnished in the eyes of many of the incarnate. It is not an edifying spectacle to witness all this ecclesiastical wrangling, with claim and counterclaim, as well as accusation and acrimony within the structure of the divinely instituted church. How would our visitor from another planet view all this? With what feelings? He would note many things, just as we observe them from the spirit world. We see, for one thing, dwindling congregations in the churches. Some of the clergy have also noticed it themselves, and those in authority say that the world is rapidly turning heathen and godless. Decay has set in the churches, and no one can stop it. They wonder why. They ask a few people for their opinion, who say that they do not go to church anymore, because the services are, for one thing, so dull. Such a reply sorrowfully surprises the ministers, because religious worship should not be spoken of in terms of dullness. Church services are not a form of amusement or light recreation. They are beautiful, and the language of the liturgy itself is inspiring, especially those portions of it which the congregation cannot understand. The church accuses the laity of degenerating into pagans because, by their congregational absence, they have abandoned God, and now worship materialism. They find, it is alleged, the worldly counter-attractions too compelling to be withstood upon the one day of the week when they should turn their minds to God in worship in His church. Abolish the counter-attractions of the Sunday, say some, and that would help to fill the churches. Would it really, and with willing worshippers? This smacks uncommonly of compulsion. Does God require or demand compulsion in His worship? Does not this suggest paganism at its worst, the very paganism of which the church condemns the laity? The services as they stand at present, and they have not altered appreciably since my days on earth, literally reek of paganism. Approach the prayer book with an absolutely clear mind, clear of all preconceptions upon the nature and character of the Father of heaven and earth, and examine the prayers for yourself. What do you see? As though you were an analytical expert seeing them for the first time, what can you deduce from the set form of prayers? You would be compelled to say that whoever God may be to whom you are addressing your ejaculations and petitions, this is His character, as revealed by the writers of the prayers. By the very framing of the sentences, their preambles, their contents, and their terminations, the writers must be supposed to know and understand something of the nature of the being to whom the prayers are being directed. Your analysis might read thus: the God whom you worship must be gratified with much homage, since so much stress is laid upon the word worship. It is impossible to deduce what pleasure or profit he can derive from such exaggerated adulation. It is manifestly wrong by all canons of spiritual conduct to accord worship to any human individual or thing upon earth as to a God. What effect, if any, can there be upon the one supreme being of great surges of praise arising to him from the people of earth, assuming that such praise ever reaches him? It must be concluded that this praise is earnestly believed to be acceptable to the deity, and must make him favorably inclined towards whatever requests and petitions are to accompany it. It would appear that all supplications must be prefaced by extreme adulation before any reasonable hope can be entertained that the prayerful request will be granted. In the event of the prayer not being answered, and no reason being able to be assigned for its failure, it must, by the use of such phrases as "Thy will be done," be assumed that the answer to prayer depends not so much upon its merits or urgency, but upon the particular whim of God. Wherefore it may be presumed that he is of uncertain temperament, that is, capricious. That he is of pronounced uncertain temper is evidenced by the varied headings under which the prayers are comprised, where, for instance, protection is sought from storms and other meteorological disturbances of varying nature, from famines. For a truly benevolent God would never visit his children with such calamities as are generally believed to have their source in the deity. The occurrence of war, for example, is usually attributed to the wrath of God being visited upon a sinful or erring nation or world. The wrath of God is mentioned in some of the prayers, and though wrath itself on occasion may be righteous, so it is claimed, yet it is never a pleasant emotion to be openly displayed, especially when it is the direct cause of wars in which so many thousands of the innocent are bound to suffer. True justice would therefore not seem to be part of the deity's character, for in no sense can that be strict justice where the innocent are punished with the guilty. Nor is there evidence of strict justice where so much mercy is pleaded, and so often, and presumably with the hope of receiving it. For where does true justice enter where mercy is extended? Is not the intelligence of the Supreme Being grossly underrated when certain irrelevant interpolations are made in the prescribed order of the services? The Ten Commandments, for instance, are said to have emanated from God. Can it afford him any pleasure, therefore, to hear them recited in numerical order as part of the liturgy in his worship? Were it merely necessary to remind the congregations of the existence of the Ten Commandments, could they not be so recalled without obtruding upon the service of worship itself? It must be assumed then that their recital carries with it some talismanic value, which in itself seems a reversion to the primitive times when superstition was only a trifle more widespread than it is today. The conclusions to be drawn from the openings of all prayers is that God must be placated and appeased by fulsome adulation, for which he has an obvious weakness, and that they must be terminated by references to theological doctrine whose obscurity of meaning must leave those who utter the prayers in extreme doubt as to the purport of what they are saying. It would appear that meaningless though the words may be, no prayer, for some inexplicable reason, can be considered of any value whatsoever without their recital. The claim that God is all love is greatly confused and largely contradicted by the numerous begging appeals against the visitation of all manner of calamities, of which, it is to be supposed, he is the source, and for which no rationally minded person on earth has ever been able to perceive the just cause. Those are some of the conclusions which you might reasonably be expected to draw were you to read a prayer book for the first time, and with a mind perfectly clear of any bias, prejudices, or preconceptions, religious or otherwise. Orthodox religion is founded upon a series of dreadful errors, the most outrageous of which is the monstrous idea of the nature of the Father of the universe. The cry is for Christian unity. Suppose it were to be brought about, what then? Would it solve all problems, or any problems at all? There was a time when the Church was very nearly one. Were those days any better than the present times? Can the Church prevent the most horrific of all occurrences, the occurrence of war, which has gone on intermittently through the passage of the centuries, yet so persistently as to introduce into at least one language the terms wartime and peacetime? Does not the Church, by implication and by its actions, approve of war? If not, how does it come about that its ministers should bless with ceremonial the very implements of war? Is it not to make a mockery of God to ask his benediction upon instruments that are to be employed in the killing of men? Why has the Church been riven with divisions and controversies and rivalries of sufficient ferocity to make men hate their neighbors, to cause acts to be passed for the suppression of religious liberty whereby the offender shall be burnt at the stake for his heresy or his apostasy or his schism, or tortured in the name of holy religion? Why has the Church failed, and failed dismally? These are many questions, my friends, for you to answer, if you wish, according to your views. What is the truth as we know it in the spirit world? The spirit world, it would be surmised, is the one place where all religious problems must be resolved. A correct surmise. Then how could Christian unity be achieved? There is only one way. It might be thought that if one could possibly get all people to think alike upon the subject of religion, then unity would be quickly and easily brought about. But people thought almost alike in the days when the church was presumed to be one and undivided. Nevertheless, the divisions came, because people began to think not alike. In other words, they began to think differently, and it must be allowed that all men, of whatever nation or period of time, should be at liberty to think differently from their neighbors. Of course, no one could quarrel with that. In the spirit world we can think what we like, but our thoughts, as with you, are regulated or influenced by our knowledge. Religious unity can never come about upon a basis of what men think, though they may, at least for the time, think alike. It must be based upon what they know. It must be based upon as full a knowledge of the facts as it is possible to acquire. Religious unity founded upon spiritual truth, absolute truth, is the only unity that can endure. There is no disputing that which is truth, absolute truth, ascertained and proved to be such. Religious truth as dispensed by orthodoxy is more often than not merely the expressed opinions of doctors and fathers of the church. Unity based upon opinions cannot last. Unity based upon natural spiritual laws will abide forever. Is not the science of mathematics founded upon fact, numerical truth? Who is there who would dispute the multiplication tables? Has there been any schism among mathematicians because some scientist expressed his opinion that 2 and 2 are 5? Is it ever likely to happen? Never, so long as sanity prevails throughout the earth. Religion, as it is generally understood, concerns among other things the welfare of the spiritual part of man, and it is the most vitally important of all subjects under the earthly sun. But religion is a veritable battleground of contention, whereas it should rest upon a high degree of exactitude acquired from absolute knowledge. If the religions had less of opinion and more of knowledge, disruption would begin to vanish with the rapidity of morning mist in the warmth of the rising sun. 1. If the churches do really and sincerely desire to become one, their only hope of ever achieving unity is by discovering the spiritual truth and in the light of it casting out from their creeds and doctrines every article that is against that truth. There will then be no need to place their doctrinal cards upon the table for all to see. There will be no need to search for at least a common factor upon which all can find some measure of agreement. Verity speaks for itself. Its voice is clear and clamant, and cannot be gainsaid. What are the possibilities of such unity ever being brought about under the conditions that I have suggested to you? As we view matters in the spirit world, there will surely come a time when the truth will be diffused throughout the earth. That is bound to happen eventually. Perhaps you will say that since the church was first instituted, hundreds of years ago, affairs have become steadily worse. The divisions have increased in number and range, while many strange religious sects have risen in all parts of the earth, each holding the most bizarre beliefs. Of the latter, one need scarcely take heed. They are mostly the outcome of slightly disordered minds, and they will disappear in time. The church that first came into being is not comparable with the numerous organizations known collectively under that appellation today. Was a church instituted? The great founder of Christianity, so-called, was not the least interested in founding any church. In good truth, he founded no church in spite of the alleged references to my church. He had no intention of establishing church or chapel nor any other form of religious organization. He came to give simple teaching to simple folk, showing them how to live their lives on earth, and how to behave towards their neighbors. He told them that the God of wrath, as they understood him to be, was indeed no God of wrath at all, but the Father of all love. He told his hearers that death of the physical body was not the end of all things, but the real beginning of life, a new life in the immense world of the Spirit. He told them that such gifts as he possessed and demonstrated, of healing the sick and speaking spiritual truths, were not mystical or magical gifts, nor were they operated through the power of the devil, but that they were natural gifts which they could themselves develop and use in the service of their fellows, if they went about it in the right way.